Welcome to another episode of Daughters of Mormonism. I'm your host, Sybil. Today we have a special edition where I'm interviewed by Zilpha from Mormon Expression. I got to visit her in her studio and we had a wonderful conversation.
This is Zilpha and I'm here today with Sybil, the founder of a brand new podcast called Daughters of Mormonism. Hello, Sybil.
Hi.
So why don't you tell me a little bit about your project and what you've done so far with it?
Okay. I started the project very recently, and so far it was mostly just me talking to myself. The first three episodes are just me, and then I just barely today posted the new episode, and it's an interview with someone who's going to be on our panel. And mostly I'm interested in exploring women's issues and women's ideas and experiences in the Mormon Church, because I think that there are a lot of issues that are specific to women, and I would like to be able to take a look at those more closely.
So I listened to one of yours. It was the language in the Book of Mormon that dealt with women in the Book of Mormon, basically, and the terminology that they used.
Yeah.
And I thought that was very insightful. I thought you did a great job.
Oh, thank you.
So what were the other ones, since there's so, you know, few so far?
Oh, yeah, there's so few.
I can totally say. Which ones they are.
Okay. The first one was called The Promises of the Checklist, and it basically talks about why I decided to start Daughters of Mormonism and how I felt that as I've grown up in the church, that it made me a lot of promises that it was not able to keep. And so no matter how hard I lived that checklist, it was never going to deliver on the promises. So that was the first one. The second one was a response to the piece that Michael Otterson, the head of the church PR, wrote called What Mormon Equality Looks Like. And he never did address what Mormon equality looks like. He just presented nice PR sounding stuff. And there was a lot of response across the Blogger Knackle to this article that he wrote. And so I did a podcast where I read through it and responded to it as I was reading it. And that was actually when I decided to make it go live, because I was kind of really nervous. I'm kind of a shy person. So I put it up and it actually spread really fast. And then I did the one that you were talking about the gender bias language in the Book of Mormon. And then the most recent one is an interview with Sarah, one of the panelists, and she tells her story. And
one of the panelists that's going to be on your podcast.
Yes. Oh, sorry. Yes. I really enjoy the way that Mormon Expression does a panel. I find it very easy to listen to, and also that I get kind of a rounder view of the topic. And especially, I think, with women's issues in the church, we're all in such very different places on these issues that to have a panel discuss them instead of just me, because then you only get, you know, Sybil's view. Yeah. but with a panel, it feels like we would be able to give a rounder view of some of the different issues, like women in the priesthood. That's a really hot piece for a lot of people. And if we had a panel talking about it, I'm guessing we would get a really full view of how that topic is being dealt with. Where if it was just me, you'd get just my view on it.
Right. Yeah, it does give a more well-rounded view. Where do you see your project in the future? Are you going to, is it a once a week kind of thing, or just whenever you finish a podcast?
I'm trying to do it every week. I try to put them up every Friday, and I've been good about that so far. So I'm hoping that keeps going. I would like to run it for a minimum of a year so that it can have at least 52. I would like it to end up being something that could be an actual resource. So I've told myself that the minimum that I will do it is a year, but I could see it going for quite some time because I think that there's a tremendous amount of...
Yeah, which is what we've found as well. I mean, it just is a treasure trove of things to explore.
Exactly.
So what is your history, your history with the church, basically?
Okay.
And where have you been, and where are you now, and where are you going, do you think?
Okay. Well, I was born in a small Mormon town in the Covenant to parents who were married in the temple, and it was a very large family, and I was the oldest daughter, and so I spent a lot of time helping raise children because I had a lot of younger brothers and sisters. And when there's a lot of kids around, everybody has to chip in. And if you're the oldest girl, you especially do. So I did that a lot. I'm trying to think how to tell the story. When I was 8 and I was baptized, I actually felt enormously guilty because my primary teacher had told me that for your baptism to work, you had to repent of every sin you had ever committed ever in your whole life for your baptism to take. You know, otherwise it wouldn't take.
Wow.
And I couldn't remember everything I'd ever done. And I was like a ridiculously, I know. And I was a ridiculously obedient child anyway. So to have this, I know. And so it wasn't until I was a teenager that I fully realized how much I'd internalized what she had said and was able to let it go and say, okay, that was her. That has nothing to do with me. I was not a wicked, wicked child.
Your baptism was fine.
My baptism was fine. So that was kind of an interesting beginning. I'm kind of a shy, awkward person. And so I was kind of an outcast in young women's because it was a small town and kind of cliquish, and the leaders liked the cute, you know, flirty, fun, vivacious, hip, stylish girls. And I was so very definitely not any of those. And so I didn't really fit in. But I lived through it and I went off to college and loved being a student, but was still very shy. Went on a mission, where I was very, very focused. But at the same time, I filled my mission journals with all kinds of interesting issues that were coming up for me during that time. And then I came back and I completed a master's degree, and then I actually even got married, which most of my family thought I would never do because I was so shy and not really very interested in guys. And so I'm planning to do a podcast about relationships and things like that, because I think that Mormon relationships tend to run very quickly in the, especially in the kind of the BYU atmosphere, the, you know, and I went very, 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 very slow.
Oh,
so,
really?
Yeah.
Even with the guy that you ended up marrying, it was a slow process.
Very slow, very gradual.
So, do you mind saying what you studied? What your master's degree is?
I studied English and I studied rhetoric quite a bit. And I don't know.
So you said that you're married and you've got your master's degree, and but you didn't say where you are in the church.
Oh, I got derailed. Okay. So where I'm at now. Okay. So I got married, and as the years went past, a lot of different issues started to come up. And one of the primary ones was how women were treated in the church. This was especially because I had one of those bishops that just makes everyone say, "What? He did what? He told me, myself, that my soul was not sacred."
What?
I know.
What does that even mean? What did he mean by that?
From what my husband and I gathered, what he meant was I was not worth helping. I was,
what?
Yeah, he was really weird, especially about women. And it was such a strange ward. It was very strange.
Had you gone to him with some of your issues and struggles, and that's why he said that, or why
kind of? Yeah, we were talking through just a couple of things that we were asking for help and guidance on.
Oh.
You know, like we were going as this in a total attitude of faith,
mm-hmm.
and he slammed us. And as we left, I was just in shock, and my husband was just walking beside me. And then he just stopped and he said, "Did that really go as bad as I thought it did?" And I said, "Yeah, I think it did." And that was interesting because it broke my trust in male leaders kind of forever. I already had a bunch of trust issues, but that broke it because that bishop just kind of was kind of a plague for us for the whole rest of the time we were in that ward. And we have since had one other bishop that really plagued us. And so, I don't know, but we've also had, for the record, two very wonderful bishops. So hooray for the wonderful bishops. I guess so. So the issues just kind of kept coming up more and more, and a lot of the women's issues became very intense for me because I wanted my mother in heaven and I wanted my own divinity and I wanted things from the temple explained and changed. And I wanted church structure and policy to include us. And I don't know, like it really started to move forward for me. And
like, you couldn't put up with it the way it was. anymore.
No.
Either it had to change or...
Or I had to get away from it. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. And then everything kind of went into warp drive when I tipped over the church history bucket. And I don't really have very many positive feelings about Joseph Smith, and his polyandry and polygamy really bother me. And the implications for women, for the doctrine that he set up and the examples that he set up and the way he treated those women and the manipulation and so forth.
Yeah, none of that bothered me until I read it myself and realized, you know, because the church acknowledges that Joseph Smith and Brigham Young had other wives. Well, they're pretty
sort of.
Yeah, they're pretty secretive about the Joseph Smith thing. But when I heard he had other wives, it didn't bother me because I'd always been taught that polygamy was only used to take care of widows. Yeah, basically to take care of widows. Like, can you imagine these old, you know, needy women who
pass their childbearing
years. Yes. But then when I realized that it wasn't like that at all, that's when it really set in. And, you know, you can't really justify it with what the church teaches today about families and about marriage. When I was growing up, I never really had a problem with the position of women in the church.
Yeah.
I didn't see any problem. I was one of those ones who kind of believed in the, well, I wouldn't want that responsibility anyway. And like, oh, well, I'll hold the priesthood every night, you know, when I get married. But I think part of the reason it didn't bother me is because for some reason I had grown up with a kind of a confidence in myself despite the church's teachings about women. And so I didn't feel personally slighted, and I didn't feel personally like God thought of me as less or anything like that. So no matter what the church said, it just didn't bother me because I knew where I stood with God, and I knew where I stood kind of in the world and my potential. So when you were dealing with these issues, did you feel personally that it was a problem with God or with the church?
Originally, I think I felt like it was a problem with God, just because God and the church were kind of inseparable from just the way I was raised in such a strong Mormon family. But fairly soon, I kind of came to start feeling like it was a problem in the church. And it was a problem in the way that things were set up in patriarchal religious cultures. Because there are times in the Old Testament where, you know, there are prophetesses, but not anymore, you know, and there are...
And not very many.
and there aren't very many, but there actually were some. Mm-hmm. And so, like, I remember suggesting to a friend one time, what if, as a way to change the way that the church is right now, what if God the Mother appeared to a 14-year-old girl in a grove of trees and, you know, revealed this big missing piece, you know?
And I was thinking about this, and I thought, well, what a great opportunity God had, you know, if the Joseph Smith story is indeed true. If he wanted to fix this stuff, he could have done it right then and there, or she could have, you know, whoever it is,
right.
That's the God, they could have fixed it. But instead, the way that the church was formed and organized and structured and run and things were taught, it made it worse. It made it worse than it was before and for women and what it was, even during their time, I think. I mean, some things are progressive in the church for women. I would say they were at the time when Joseph Smith was setting it up. So like the women's organization that they formed.
Yeah.
But at the same time, women were never equals.
And
no. In my opinion, if there was a God who cared about women being equals, that would have been a great time to start setting that up.
Yes.
Yeah.
I completely agree. And so the message of if God has anything important to do, he will work through his prophets.
Right.
And that is how it will be accomplished. And I was like, well, wait a minute. What about me? Because I feel like I have things to do in this world. You know, there are things I'm going to do because I am a human being and I have potential and worthwhileness and what, I don't know if that's a word.
Intelligence.
But, you know, it was like, well, why couldn't I be someone that steps forward and does things even though I'm shy? I think maybe it's a shy person thing that we always think we could, you know, step out and do something really great
if we just had
the guts.
Yeah.
So, you know, to see all my brothers, you know, being ordained to all these different offices in the priesthood, and then to go on a mission and to see all these elders who were younger than I was being in positions of authority over me and how bad they botched it sometimes because, hey, they were male. You know, they were male. So they were the ones that God wanted to enact and do these things. And
it's hard not to feel like a second-class citizen when you're always treated that way.
Yeah.
And that was one of the things that motivated us to stop going to church. Once we kind of, our faith had deflated, then we had to figure out, okay, so do we still want to be a part of it even though we don't believe, or do we want to step out? And the reason why we decided to step out was for our daughter who was going into Sunbeams, and her perceptions would start to be formed, and she would see the men all sitting on the stand and directing the meetings and being in charge. And we didn't want her to have that in her subconscious or her psychology anywhere, that somehow men are to be in charge and women are to be subservient.
Yeah. The men lead and the women do the work.
Mm-hmm. So that was a big, big motivator for us.
Definitely.
So we wanted to talk about different stages of transitioning out of the faith and out of Mormonism.
Yeah.
And how we can determine morality and spirituality and how those change through the transitions.
Yeah.
So did you have any ideas about that, or do you?
I was kind of really hoping for some ideas from you because I feel like I'm kind of newer on my path, but.
Oh, it's so hard. I mean, when I think about spirituality, that used to really mean a lot to me, and I always kind of saw myself as a spiritual person until I stopped believing in things of a spiritual nature, like literally like supernatural things. So the term spirituality doesn't mean what it used to me, but morality still has a bigger weigh-in on my mind and my heart. But the problem with morality is that it's slippery and it's hard to get a grip on because different people see it so differently and different cultures. Some things are moral in one culture, which would be immoral in another culture. So does that mean that morality is a spectrum, and does it have, I don't know, is it bouncy? Sometimes, I don't know, I think about Nephi cutting off the head of Laban to save a whole nation, so even if that did happen, looking at it from one perspective, you'd say, yeah, well, of course that's moral. I mean, if you're going to save thousands of people by killing one person, then that is moral. But on the other hand, is it ever okay to kill someone just because you think you should? Then when do you stop? I mean, But as far as actually things in my life that I can determine and find moral value in, being a wife, that changed because my view of what a wife is and what a marriage is changed when I stopped believing that marriage is eternal, because once it's finite, And I do believe that it is finite, that there is an end to life, then is it worth it? And what's the point? And I guess it's not that big of a question to me because I enjoy my marriage. And of course, it's worth it because every day is better because I'm with John and we share a life together. But it did change the way I think about it. And it's more of a choice to be married rather than this is the way it is. You're going to be together forever and, whatever that means. that it is worth sticking it out with someone that you love and getting through the hard times, because there are more good times than bad times. And if that's the case, then it's worth it.
How did it change your view of the role of being a wife? Like, in the church,
it really changed.
It's such a big, defined role. You're supposed to be all supportive. And I don't know, like, how did it change that for you?
Well, John has always been so egalitarian in our relationship. And sometimes it was uncomfortable for me when I was in the church, when he would just be like, he always saw me as a complete equal. And sometimes I'd want him to take charge, and I'd want him to, you know, say, okay, let's read the scriptures, take charge in the spiritual things. And he never wanted to be like the dominant leader in our home. He always saw us as partners. So I didn't have that much of a transition, because I got used to it over time. And that's just the way it was. How about for you, as you've detangled some of your psychology from the church?
Well, it's interesting, because I didn't want to get married, because when I looked around at all the marriages around me, which were predominantly Mormon marriages, I didn't see any that I liked. And so I didn't think that it looked like a real good idea to get married.
What didn't you like about
them? That they seemed to be built more on a love that was manifested by tolerance instead of a love that was manifested by wanting to be together.
And enjoyment.
Yes, but enjoyment. Yeah, that's a good way to put it. That here were all these spouses that were so lovingly tolerating the other. And, you know, oh, my dear wife who never lets me go astray, or my husband who is the worthy priesthood holder of our home. And it's like they tolerated each other because they fulfilled this role in the eternal plan of God, kind of a thing. And they didn't seem to be friends. I don't deny that they have love. I do think they have love, but it wasn't anything that I was interested in being part of. And so part of the reason that my marriage was so very slow coming about, even once I had found someone that I would actually want to commit my life to, was because we were unraveling a lot of issues with church gender roles and things like that. And that was really good, because it helped us to build a solid foundation of communication and helped us move toward more of an egalitarian approach, even before we were married. And then we've continued to build on that as I've gone on my journey. So I kind of refused to buy into what everybody else was doing. And I only saw two marriages in my whole formative period before I was married that I thought were any good. Is that pathetic?
Wow. I mean, I never really kept track.
Well, I never saw any until I saw the first one. And then the second one was about 4 years later. And they were the only two that I thought, okay, they're like respecting each other as humans. And they believe that each other can accomplish things that don't have to be defined by one or the other. And not only the man gets to follow his dreams, but the woman also. And they were both LDS marriages, though one was very fringe and the other was very faithful. And so it was interesting to see those two. But that was two, and that was it. So, but it gave me a little piece of hope that maybe I could do that, that I could redefine marriage for me.
I think that even harder than the marriage definition that changed was motherhood, my role as a mother, and how I saw that role. I mean, once you're a mother, you just are. But as far as what kind of mother you're supposed to be and how you go about it, that can change. And so when I was believing, I thought that being a mother would fulfill my spiritual needs and kind of put me on my path to my destiny. I mean, that was basically what my eternal role would be, was to be a mother. And so obviously it was going to be just full of joy and satisfaction. And yet when I became a mother, which I very much wanted, it was so much harder and less satisfying than I imagined that it was going to be.
Yeah.
And so, but you know, you just play the role, and you basically sacrifice yourself to try to be a perfect mother. And that's what I was, the trap I was in for a little while until I finally realized that, first of all, the church isn't true, which then gave me license to reexamine my role as a mother and to be able to say, I love my children. I'm glad I'm a mother, but that's not all I am, and that's not all I want to be. And that was hard. It took me a few years to really come to grips with being able to let go of my need to try to be a perfect mother, and instead just to give my kids the things that they needed and the environment that they needed without sacrificing myself and my needs.
Yeah.
So, do you have children?
I don't have children. Yeah, it hasn't happened. So
that was a change for me.
But that's one of the issues that I also have thought a lot about, is the way that women as wives and as mothers are very much encouraged to give themselves to their husbands and their children and not give anything to themselves.
Mm-hmm.
And so they kind of shrivel up and dwindle. And
right. The idea is that as you give, you grow and you blossom and you feel your well. Well, that's not really the case. I mean,
yeah.
Giving does promote growth and it does give you something back, but not if you're always giving and not if you don't take time for the things that you enjoy and the things that stimulate your mind. And I just think it's a disservice to a lot of women when the church encourages them to stay at home with their children. I think it's psychologically damaging to women because they're isolated and they don't have a lot of external contact.
Yeah.
And all it is children all day long who don't stimulate your mind, who, and you know, Blue's Clues and Dora are just kind of mind numbing. They're cute and they're good for kids, but women are not an extension of their children and they shouldn't be.
No, they're human beings.
Right. So, I mean, but at the same time, I wanted to be that mother who stayed home, and I didn't want my kids to be, you know, someone else taking care of them more than I was. So
right.
It was really, really challenging. And I'm still not satisfied. There's no good answer. Once you have children, whether you're in the church or out of the church, you're always torn by the desire to provide everything to your children and the desire to be your own person.
Yeah. I remember in some of the long conversations that my husband and I had before we got married, when we were having our very slow friendship, one of them was about women staying home with their children. And I said, just so you know, I don't believe that I should have that be my entire sphere,
mm-hmm.
that is my one sphere of being. I said, I believe that that's unhealthy psychologically. I think that the woman needs many spheres, because then if things are going bad in her one sphere, she has nowhere to go.
Mm-hmm.
But the man has, you know, his work and his church is even fairly separate, where with the woman, her church calling seemed to just kind of double onto her motherhood.
Mm-hmm.
And, but the man, you know, if he's like the leader, whatever, I don't know, like their callings just don't seem to say, and now this is part of one of your spheres. It's not part of their fatherhood. It's their church sphere.
Right.
So they have work and church and home and maybe several others. I don't know, but for the woman to have one sphere, then she can never leave that sphere when something's going wrong. But the man can say, man, things are going bad at home. I'm going to hang out here at work.
Yeah.
Or things are not going so hot here at work. I'm going to go home. And
the woman has nowhere to go.
The woman has no recourse. And so I remember when we had that discussion, he had, you know, heard all of the church paradigm growing up. And he said, no. The woman's place is in the home to raise the children. And I was adamant. I said, no, that's not healthy. That's not healthy. And
it might be great for the kids.
It might be great for the kids, but it would be.
But at the same time, if they have a mother who's
burned out,
not psychologically healthy, who's just playing a role that she doesn't enjoy, that's not going to be good for them.
No. So it was interesting because he finally said, okay, I'm done with this conversation for now. I'll talk to you later. And 3 days later, he came back and he said, you win. He had been watching all his friends who had married and had children. He'd been watching, you know, other mothers and so forth. And he had seen over and over and over exactly what I was talking about. And he suddenly started to feel the stiflement and the trappedness
mm-hmm.
of these women who were following their Mormon dream to marry in the temple and raise righteous children unto the Lord, and suddenly finding themselves in what felt like kind of a prison. Mm-hmm. Even though they loved the children dearly, their souls were shriveling up.
There are a few women. I mean, there's always exceptions. There are some women who just love it and just eat it up.
Yes, and I know a couple like that,
and
they're amazing.
But I mean, yeah, but everybody's not the same, and we shouldn't try to be, because it just makes for miserable people.
And I think that those women who thrive on it in that way, I think that they're the exception.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think they're the rule, but the church sort of implies that they are the rule, that if we are sufficiently righteous and faithful, we will just thrive on staying home with the kids.
Square peg in the round hole.
Totally.
Is there any last words from you, Sybil?
Let's see. Last words. We're hoping to really get into some of these different issues, like we've been discussing about the roles of wife and mother and the ways that women are seen in the church and so forth. We're hoping to really dig into some of these and ask some of the harder questions over on Daughters at Mormonism. And I'm really looking forward to meeting lots of new people and lots of new ideas and seeing what we can create as women.
I think that there's a need for a podcast like the one that you're doing, and I think you're doing a great job. And I look forward to hearing what other women have to say about these issues. And good luck with your project.
Thank you so much.
Thanks for listening to Daughters of Mormonism. I invite you to respond at daughtersofmormonism.blogspot.com. If you have ideas for future episodes, I'd love to hear about them. Thanks to Kevin McLeod for the music.